Mark Caro, and welcome to episode 201 of Caro Pop. If you'd like to support us, please go to caropop.com. Our guest this week is one of Australia's and the world's premier singer-songwriters over the past several decades, Paul Kelly. Before too long, the one that you're loving, the wish that he never met you. I was introduced to Kelly's work back in 1987, when his album Gossip, with his band The Messengers, was released in the U.S. on A&M. It includes the singles Before Too Long and Darling It Hurts, both in my wheelhouse for smart, tuneful, three-minute pop rock songs. That album got Kelly and the Messengers to tour the U.S. with fellow Down Under popsters Crowded House and on their own. The follow-up album, Under the Sun, features another indelible single, Dumb Things. What has become a Kelly standard, To Her Door. He was riding through the cane in the pouring rain on a limping to her door. Fast forward to now, and Kelly at age 70 is one of those singer-songwriters who has continued to create music at a high level. Even his voice sounds undiminished, and I ask him how he managed that. His new album, titled 70, is out November 7th, and is full of deep reflections, vivid storytelling, and earworms. One of the songs, Rita Wrote a Letter, is a sequel to Kelly's popular 1996 song, How to Make Gravy, which was turned into a 2024 Australian film. Spoiler alert. Things haven't worked out great for main character Joe, but he plays out his fate in a humorous, super catchy way. Another song, The Body Keeps the Score, was inspired by the work of a Dutch-American psychiatrist and considers the toll of living on your physical being. Kelly, like the rest of us, can relate. There's a stranger at my door with a bill I haven't paid. The body keeps the score. He has stories about his years of living, from growing up in Adelaide, Australia, to his current life in Melbourne, with many adventures in between. He discusses his career, whether he ever considered moving to the U.S., and his years of being what he calls a recreational heroin user. How does he write songs these days? Does he view songwriting as a way to make sense out of being human? What has he learned over the years? His observational powers remain unrivaled. Please enjoy this Caro Pop conversation with Paul Kelly. Know what you're going through. The album's called 70, which you're getting to that title before Adele, so that's good. And she's got to wait a little longer before she could use that. But you sound remarkably similar to in terms of your voice and everything, you were, you know, in the 80s or something. What is it you're doing with your voice that makes you sound the same or pretty close?
Well, my voice is still getting better, so I guess that's my, you know, one good thing. You know, my range is bigger now than it was when I was younger. I can actually get higher and get lower, so it's probably just been fortunate that way. But also, I think it's just through singing a lot. I generally find when at the end of a tour, I'm singing better than at the start. So it's like use it or lose it, I think, with a voice.
Interesting. Because there are people whose voices get kind of deeper, you know, like someone like Elton John, then there are people whose voices get kind of reedy, but yours sounds great. So good job.
Yeah. my nephew Dan, you know, who's played with me a lot, you know, in the band and as a duo, he sort of calls it an indestructible voice, or like a voice, a bit like a buzz. You know, it's got this sort of really mid-range buzz frequency. So it cuts. It's pretty loud. It's always, you know, so, you know, maybe it's just genetics, but so far so good. Touching wood now.
There you go. So you've obviously recorded a lot of albums, some with bands, some solo, some with, you know, bands you obviously assemble for the album.
you called this one 70, which is your age this year. What are you still learning?
Oh, what am I still learning? I'm just trying to learn to take things as they come. I don't know what I'm learning, really. I've always been a little bit suspicious of the idea that as you get older, you get wiser. So I don't feel any wiser. But I feel, you know, one good thing about being, you know, having lived this long and, you know, having loved, you know, poetry and literature, that I have a lot of stuff in my head, I guess. There's one of the songs on the record sort of refers to that, treasures in your mind. So, you know, I have a lot of poetry in my head that's I don't need to look up to say or, say out loud or just say in my mind. So, you know, lots of poems I love, lots of Shakespeare. So that's kind of a good feeling to sort of know, oh, you know, anywhere I go, I've got this little library in my head. I don't need to look up. I need a phone. I don't need a book. It's just I've got this library, you know, from, you know, waiting at a bus stop or waiting in line somewhere or just killing time. And then, you know, I can just say some poems in my head. You know, that's all you. The other thing you do is, of course, just do nothing. I think being a songwriter is really, really trying to get to that state of not doing, you know, of idleness. I mean, songs come out of idleness. There's a great emphasis these days on being busy. People seem to pride themselves on being busy. You ask them how you're going, they say, oh, I'm busy.
Right.
You know, I do get busy, but I don't like being busy. So I'm always, much of my life is like trying to get to unbusyness, you know, clear the decks, not have anything else going on. And sometimes, you know, you're ready then to start maybe catching a song or the start of a song.
Yeah, there's nothing more boring than hearing people talk about how busy they are. It doesn't really, you know, it's like, busy. Okay, everyone's busy. Do songs come to you similarly to how they have over the years?
Yeah, there's really not much difference to, you know, 40 years ago. There is one big difference, which I'll get to in a minute, but generally it's scrappy, it's scratching around. Most of the time it's trying to write and being stuck. I always write things. If I think of a line or, you know, hear somebody say something or read something that I think might be good in a song, I write it down. So that's the first rule, because if you don't, it disappears within a minute or two. So
right.
I've learned from experience.
Do you write on paper or do you use like little phone memos?
I used to write it. Used to have a little notebook carry on. Now I write onto the phone, and then but if I'm at home, I'll write in a notebook. I actually like writing longhand into notebooks. So I don't know why. I think it's makes the brain work a little bit differently. But most of the time, because out and about or just quickly, it's just quickly to put on the phone straight away. And then sometimes I'll start transferring stuff into a notebook.
Do you do the same thing with like snippets of melody? Do you get like a little hook in your head and record that as well?
Yeah. So I have those two things going on. So I have lots and lots and lots of melody ideas. And so often if I'm, you know, got to clearing the decks to write songs, I'll sort of trawl through these recordings. They're on my phone now too. I mean, they used to be on on cassettes and tape recorders, but they're just on the phone now. So I've got the just jottings of lyrics and snippets of melody. Sometimes sort of close to whole songs in structure, but just with no words, just sounds. Often it's just getting words to fit the sounds that I make when I'm having ideas. So,
do you tend to sort of like get like a structure of like a whole song and then maybe have a phrase and then the words are like the last thing to come in terms of just filling out all those spaces, or is it, does it depend on the song?
That's probably most often how it happens. You have sometimes I'll have I think I can hear. There's a song here. I've got melodies. I've got some verses. I've got, you know, another bit, bridge or whatever you call it. And I've got something that's like a chorus, and this could be a song. And I might have, you know, just I might have the title that I'm singing, or I might have a line here or there, and it's sort of often just sort of sounds or proto words or sort of just kind of gibberish, really. And then just getting the slowly getting the words to onto the melody, and that there, that's sort of probably my main way for long. But something did happen about 13 years ago when I was asked to write music for a youth classical orchestra with a modern classical composer, contemporary composer, and we turned to they asked us to write a song cycle, and I thought I can't write a song cycle, but I could maybe choose some poems around a theme and do that. So we started putting some poetry to music. Kenneth Slessor, Australian poet, Tennyson, Emily Dickinson, W.B. Yeats, and so on. And we put music to that. And that was the first time I would ever actually had the words first and then put music to it. And that was a revelation, because up until then I'd always thought that I couldn't write with the words first, because I had this notion that it would somehow restrict the music or make the melody, make everything be too rigid. But I was completely wrong, and I discovered that you can start with a set of words and you can still be free with the melody musically.
So have you done that since then?
What's that?
Have you done that with songs since then? We'll write a full set of lyrics and then...
Exactly. So that sort of turned the key for me. So after that project, which was in 2012, next thing I did, I put a Shakespeare sonnet to music, and then thought, oh, that's great. And, you know, the sonnets are actually perfect for songwriters, because... The 14 lines, they rhyme. There's sort of lots of four. There's three lots of four, and then the couplet at the end. The first two lots of four can be like verses, and in the sonnet, you know, the Shakespearean sonnet, traditionally, there's after eight lines, it's what's called a turn. So the next four lines sort of have a slightly, they shift the view, or they bring another element in, so that can work like a bridge. The couplet at the end, which both lines rhyme, can be like a chorus. So it's sort of well suited to adapting to, you know, what you would call a classic pop song. You've got verses, bridge, and a chorus.
It's a different kind of classic.
Yeah. So I did I did a record of Shakespeare's sonnets in 2016, on the 400th anniversary of his death. Ever since then, I've just occasionally sort of, I like a poem, I say, I wonder if I could put music to that. It's something that happens, you know, usually quickly or doesn't happen at all. So, yeah, now I would have put over 60 poems to music, you know, over those last 10 years. Some of them end up on records. Sailing to Byzantium is a Yeats poem that's right on this record. The Magpies is a poem by a New Zealand poet. So it's just become part of how I write songs. It's another way for me to write songs, which... You know, I've been, before that point, I've been writing songs for close to 40 years, and to find a new way to write songs was sort of a real thrill. It's like, hey, because every writer wants to break their own habits. We all have our own patterns and grooves and habits, and a lot of the time you're trying to break them. So for me to be able to find a new way to write songs at that age, you know, 13 years ago, it felt like a blessing.
Well, and the other thing is that you still have this facility for creating melodies. And like, sometimes I wonder when there are songwriters who are a little more melodic, whether at some point they're going to run out of hooks or something like that. And there are some who, you know, you can hear sort of earlier in their career, they were just, their songs were maybe a little stickier, for a better, lack of a better word, than some of the later ones. I mean, when you're someone like Paul McCartney and you've written like the stickiest songs in the world, you're not going to expect Egypt Station to be up there with, you know, even Band on the Run. But you're, you know, this album, I mean, there's plenty of stuff that's like as catchy as anything you've done, as well as the lyrics being sharp. I mean, something like Rita Wrote a Letter, which is A, a sequel song and B, just super catchy single on its own. I don't know. It's like, do you sort of worry that it's like, oh, I'm going to run out of these? Or is there sort of some part of you that's pleased? Like, well, look, I still got this gift for these hooks and everything.
Well, melodies seem to come sort of pretty easily to me. That's not something I really think about much. But oftentimes I'll sit down and be trying to write and mucking around, singing stuff over some chords and stuff. And I think, oh, that's boring. That's a boring melody. So when you have so many melodies in your head
that you've already written, I just think, you know, it's always like, I mean, I'm someone who's sort of like, I'll write things just totally on the side. But it's like when you come up with something that still sounds original after all these years, it's kind of like a lightning bolt. Like, oh, good. Thank you.
Yeah. I mean, it always feels pretty fluky. So, a lot of the time, a lot of songwriting for me is just being bored or boring myself and nothing much happening, or what I'm singing is saying, oh, that sounds too close to someone else, or that sounds too close to something. It's not like you sit around waiting for inspiration. You've got to turn up, you've got to go and just play the guitar, or I play the piano as well. I mean, very basically, but I play guitar pretty basically and guitar pretty basically. So I do often sort of bore myself because it's not like I can sort of amuse myself with a great fluency on both those instruments. I'm just generally, when I'm playing, I'm sort of reaching around for a song. I don't usually get melodies unless I'm playing an instrument, playing the guitar or piano. That's usually how they come.
Right.
I never know when the next one will come. And probably that was, I think, in the past, if there'll be weeks and months without, having a song, getting a song, I would sort of feel that sort of anxiety about it, I feel useless, because that's my main thing. My main job is writing songs. So if songwriting was really slow, that would worry me, but it doesn't now. I have slowed down. I don't write songs as much as I used to.
You did have an album come out last year, Fever Longing Still, and then you have 70 this year. So it seems like you've had sort of a prolific burst, at least in terms of producing, two albums in 2 years.
Yeah, it's been pretty steady. It never feels like it's very, doesn't feel steady, but, you get a half a dozen songs a year, sometimes more. Yeah, it sort of builds up. I just, when I get a group of songs that I've written and I get the band together and we go into the studio and record them. We don't sort of record these days like we're going in to make an album. We just go in and record whatever songs I've got. And then I put them into what I call the odd sock straw on my computer, music folder in the computer. And so we just have a built, have a stack of, like a stockpile of songs. And then when I see it, get a few songs that I think, oh, these ones belong together, maybe this could be the kernel of a record. So that's sort of generally how albums take shape for me when I've got enough songs in the odd socks drawer and talking to each other. Then I
there
start
you go.
Together.
Well, and this one starts and ends with Tell Us a Story, parts A and B. And I was sort of wondering, because you have, if you left them together, it would have been a 6-minute song, and you have plenty of 6-minute songs. Did you just sort of like the idea of kind of starting and ending the album on this? And it ends on like a very nice set of lines. It sort of feels like a sort of album ending, end of an album. But is that, like, how did you look at sort of those bookending the record?
The idea to do that came late. I always thought Tell Us a Story would be the first song on the record, because it was an introduction. It's a song that sort of said, come on, gather around, we're coming in to all be together, the ones I love, telling stories around a fire. So I thought that's a great way to sort of, it's an inviting song, and inviting people into the record, and also with the theme of storytelling. And then it was, it just turned out to be 6.5 minutes long, I think. And I thought, well, that's all right. And I thought, I wonder if maybe that's a bit too long to start a record. You want to get people into the other songs quicker. And also, it's a fairly repetitive song. I wouldn't say that's one of my more melodic ones. It's more of a, I guess it's got a tune. I sort of half talk, half sung to a lot of my songs. Then I thought, just had the idea, oh, maybe it could be, we could cut this song in half, do a fade out and fade back, reprise at the end of the record. And then we've got this, they're like bookends, and they sort of, within those two bookends, there's the record, which again is storytelling.
Right. Well, and it ends on the lines, that bitter wind keeps howling outside our creaking door, but our roof is snug and tight and we have enough in store. And even if soon this old world is giving up the ghost, well, I don't mind because I'm right here with the ones I love the most. Like, that's a pretty lovely way to end an album, especially when you're going to give it a title like 70, which is kind of like, this is where I am right now.
Yeah. And I think, and you just hear on the fade out of that song, it's like, I think the last thing you hear is, I'd get another log for the, I'm going to get another log for the fire. So, yeah, I thought that's a pretty good way, cool way to end the record.
And Rita Wrote a Letter is a sequel to a, 28-year-old song, How to Make Gravy. It's the same characters. Things have gone not well for Joe, your narrator. Where did that come from? Like, did you sort of think, you know what, I want to write a sequel to this, or did you sort of start on the song and then think, you know what, I'm going to use those characters. I'm just going to revisit these characters people love.
No, I am. For a long time, I've been thinking it'd be great to have a sequel to this song, more from Rita's point of view, because she gets just a passing mention in the original song, How to Make Gravy. I thought it'd be great to do something where you hear more from Rita. So I wrote down this line. This is about 7 years ago. I wrote down the line, Rita Wrote a Letter, and thought, well, there's my title. And then I sort of went back to it every now and then and tried to write something and wrote some lines, and I didn't really have any tune, but I was sort of just writing lines down, but got stuck, left it, came back to it. This is all normal. As I was saying before, most of the time as a songwriter, your main state of being is being stuck. So most of the time you're stuck, and every now and then you get a little surprise and you shift. So I was stuck, 6 or 7 years. I wasn't, it was just something I would go back to every now and then and have a play with, and nothing had really caught fire until my nephew Dan came over. He plays in my band. I've mentioned him before. And he had a piece of piano music, which is the music you hear at the start of that song, a sort of New Orleans type sort of riff on the piano. And he had a start of a tune. And I started singing along, and the first thing I sang was, I really don't know how I'm talking 6 feet down and under the clay.
Right.
So I thought, oh, am I really, is this what's happening? Is this what's happening? Have I just killed Joe off? Do I really want to do this? And I had, I think I thought for about 5 seconds, and then I thought, yes, I am, because it was just so, the idea of doing this is so much fun. So now I knew that Joe was dead, and then he could be sort of singing from beneath the ground. Sort of like I came up in folk music, where moles speak from the ground, and ghosts come, and people get up from the dead and haunt you, and so on. So I think this would be great. I've got a ghost story. It's going to be. To me, it was sort of, comic, but, it was also with a dark side because, Joe died. So, the song came pretty quick after I had that little key about, oh, he's singing about what's happened. So,
right.
The story unfolds from there. But, the funny thing is, we get Rita's side of the story because she's the voice of the choruses all the time. But the rest of the song is Joe's still talking. And I was worried about killing Joe off because, How to Make Gravy is a song here that people have taken to heart. And I thought, are they going to be upset that I've killed Joe? but maybe they will, but too bad. I'm going to do it anyway. Ironically, Joe, he might be dead. He's under the ground, but he he doesn't stop talking. You can't shut him up. I mean, you just hear him. He's still on the end of the, as it song fades out. He's right. Still ranting away. So,
bitching about Dan, and then he doesn't mean it, just like he didn't mean it at the end of Honey yeah. Gravy. So, and the music is so upbeat, and you know, again, like very catchy, and you just want to sing along with it. That it's sort of. It's an interesting relationship of the music because you could have written some very dark music to go with this tale, and then it would have been this sad, tragic thing. But instead, it's kind of jaunty, even though he's singing from under his 6 feet of clay. So the balance of it is kind of what makes the song, I think.
Yeah, big touchstone for me is Hank Williams right from when I started, and His music, his tunes and melodies are often upbeat, and the words are often the saddest words in the world. I mean, you listen to, I know quite a few people have said, oh, the saddest song in the world is, you know, Hear That Lonesome, I'm So Lonesome I Could Cry, the Hank Williams song. And it's funny, I've heard so many versions of that song, and that every one of them is slower than the original. You go back to Hank's original, and the band's playing, and the band's got a real pep in their step. I mean, they're just like, it pokes along. It's like it's not wallowing in itself.
Right.
I think so. I love songwriting where the music is, like you say, contrasted to the words. They sort of cut against each other a bit. Otherwise, if you sink into something too much, you can just sort of get leaden and a bit boring.
First song you ever wrote?
It was a four-line song that I wrote on an open tune G, and it's called The Going Down. It's the running around that breaks you. It's the falling apart that makes you. It's the riding of trains that takes you. It's the going down that wakes you. Four lines. I sang that over sort of this sort of open tuning thing. Yeah.
How old were you when you did that?
19.
At that point, did you know you
wanted... No, 21. I didn't write my first song until I was 21. Yeah. So, yeah. I picked up guitar. I sort of started guitar late. I mean, I did trumpet in high school and had piano lessons as a 10 and 11-year-old for a couple of years before that. Left school, traveled around, you know, fell in with a group of people that were playing, you know, Neil Young, Graham Parsons, this is 73, started, you know, the Allman Brothers, Graham Parsons, Flying Burritos, and yeah, Neil Young was big as well. And then I didn't start, you know, trying to play guitar till I was 18 with those people. And, you know, just did play a lot of folk music as well. And learned all those songs and Dylan songs, and then when I was 21, I wrote my first song.
Did you write it with the intention of performing it? You know, like, did you have visions of this being a career or life or any of that at that point?
Yes. Yeah, I think so. I'm trying to think back. Yeah, definitely. When I wrote that first song, I thought, oh, well, if I can write one, I can write another one. So, yeah. And so I did write another one. I think next one was can't remember. We Don't Get On. I think We Don't Get On was the next one. Anyway, it's not songs I play anymore. But I just started writing more songs. And then it was really, there wasn't anyone else who was going to sing him. So I thought, well, I wasn't thinking at that stage of I'll write songs for other people. I thought I'll write songs that I can sing. And so for a long time it was just writing songs and, well, no one else is going to sing them, so it may as well be me.
What was the first song you wrote where you thought, hey, this is like a great song, you know? This is like a song the world could know.
It's It's funny because that's always shifting. Sometimes you write something, this is great, this is great, and then, you know, the next day you think, oh, what was I thinking? Or, you know, a week later you think, no, it's not that good. I remember a song from Post called From St Kilda to King's Cross, and I thought, I think this is a good one. And, you know, I think, I guess I was right in the sense that it's a song I still play. That for me is, you know, what sort of, in my mind, whether a song's any good or not, is it one I can still play and, you know, feel good to play and, you know, feel true when I sing it. So,
right.
Probably that one.
And did you see yourself as a singer-songwriter, or did you see yourself as someone who would be in a band? And maybe you'd be the front person because you're writing the songs and singing them, but it was going to be like a band sort of experience for you, which you obviously had for a while.
Yeah, I guess more of a singer-songwriter, but generally, I was in a band for a little while where there was a few songwriters, and a band called the High Rise Bombers. It lasted about 8 months, but I wanted to have a band doing my song. So, but it wasn't like you know, starting a band with the group of people and just becoming a band. I mean, I'm it's a bit of both, I guess. I love being in a band, and I love what the camaraderie of a band, and especially the band I've been playing with now, which has been the youngest members of the band have been with me for 17 years. Pete, my drummer, I first played with him in 93. You know, Bill and Dan since the start of the century, 25 years or more. So I love that part of the band, having a group of people that you have a shared language. They'll all really have great encyclopedic knowledge of music. And we can, you know, we can sort of follow any idea or any sort of hunch that we get for a song. So, though I see myself very much as a singer-songwriter, I also very much love being in a band.
What were your ambitions, you know, early on? Did you have thoughts about, like, we're going to be a band and we're going to conquer the U.S. and have big, you know, major label records and that sort of thing? Like, and how much of sort of your idea of success was sort of tied into any of the sort of commercial part of it?
But yeah, but both. I mean, there's two things going on. You know, one I've always loved, especially working with Steve Connolly, worked with me between 84 and 91 and the Messengers records. He was very much, he loved pop music. What we would, you know, when maybe people think of pop music something somewhat differently now, but when I say pop music, I mean just music that was made for the radio in the 60s and 70s. And then we used like short songs and strong hooks and all that. So I've always leant towards that kind of music, and Steve Connolly, who played guitar with me, was very much of that idea too, and that band. So we liked short songs, we liked pop songs, we liked we weren't trying to be obscure or arty. We just wanted to, you know, write songs that a whole lot of people would like. So there was always that ambition. Wanted, and you know, went to the States for the first time in 88 and played. No, 87 with doing some shows with Crowded House. So
yeah, that was when Gossip came out. I think that came out in the States in 87. And yes. I think that's the first I knew of you, because I think Before Too Long was the first song I heard. And I think I got that. And I got that album too. So yeah. So that was sort of the breakthrough. And you came over with Crowded House. So you had another, you know, Australian band to tour with.
Yeah.
What was that? New Zealand. I was gonna say, as I said it, I knew it was wrong. I apologize.
Well, they were a mix. They had a mix, so they were.
Yeah, yeah. You know, felt
New Zealand
wrong.
Claims them, we claim them as well. Yeah,
closer together than, you know, if someone from England or something. But what was that experience like for you?
Oh, that was great. That was really, you know, probably we, you know, we sort of started at this sort of pretty great level, playing in these beautiful theatres, 2,000 people. We've crowded the house every night. We get up and do a song with them at the end of the night. They were, you know, Don't Dream It's Over was just starting to break across the state. So it was an exciting time for them and for us being with them. And then, you know, sort of tours after that were probably a bit more of a grind. We just keep coming back. Yeah, to go back to the start of your question, I mean, wide success is something I love, but also it's not something you can plan for, or it's sort of something out of your control. So it's not really like a campaign. We've got to be big overseas, or we got to do this, we got to do that. What I love is writing songs and working out how to record them and then playing them, and then wherever that takes you, then that's it. I mean, that's what show business is, kind of full of chance and strange turns. You sort of just got to roll with it.
Right. Did you feel that way at the time, or was it, did it mess with your head a little bit? I mean, again, you're touring with Crowded House. They've got a hit. You've got these, you know, great, you know, singles that you're putting out. Did that sort of affect how you kind of, I don't know, viewed the whole experience and what you were doing?
It's hard to remember. I know I felt frustrated in subsequent years trying to, you know, build up audiences in the States. But at some point it's like, just do the thing that's in front of you, you know, play where people want to hear you.
Right.
So that's how it's been. So.
What was your impression of the States in general, you know, having toured around?
Those early years of playing the States, I mean, for us it was an amazing experience, because we had grown up with so much American music, American TV, American films. You know, I remember going to all these, you know, going to the Grand Canyon or first time, or, you know, New York for the first time. I guess the main feeling was this deep familiarity. And so America was sort of a very strange place to us. I mean, it's so similar, but it's got these differences that are quite fundamental, I think. But it also felt deeply familiar. Everywhere we went, we knew a movie or a TV show or a song that related to it. So, we loved it. I mean, I still love, I think America today, I think it's just a great country. It's a country with everything in it, everything, and its opposite is America. And Walt Whitman said, the American poet of America contains multitudes.
Right.
Still true.
Did you think about settling down here for at any point, or did you always want to be back in Australia?
We had a few stints of being here for, you know, a few months at a time. I think 6 months was probably the longest, in around 94, 95. A few months at the end of 88, 89, when we stayed and made a record. Everything's Turning to White. We made that record in Los Angeles with Scott Litt. So we'd finished a tour. I stayed on and did some traveling around with my young family, and then we came back to LA and made a record. It was always going to live in Australia. That was sort of where family was, and it was just a bit complicated to try and move permanently. You know, probably because, you know, when I was sort of old in a way, you know, I was in my 30s when I first went to the States. And I mean, these days, young people, they leave school and they travel overseas. I mean, it was sort of like a big deal back in early, in the mid 70s to go overseas, you know.
Just, right.
It didn't seem like this far off thing, way too expensive to catch a plane. It was much harder to travel. So by the time, you know, we started going over there to play, I had sort of fairly, my life had already sort of taken root here. So it was hard to sort of uproot things. If, you know, if I'd gone to States when I was, you know, in my early 20s, could, without commitments, could well have ended up staying there or anywhere I traveled, really.
Yeah. You've written and talked about, you know, at some point you had some drug issues that you were overcoming. Was that in this period around then also when you were putting these records out, or was that beforehand?
Yeah, you know, I've been a recreational heroin user for many years, from the late 70s till 2000. So over 20 years, but it was, I never, you know, had a habit or took it every day. It was, I used it as, you know, reward for at the end of work or something to do on a day off. It was, my experience was not sort of the typical narrative that you get for people involved in that drug. Usually it's, you know, down, you go down to the pits and then you have your redemption story. Which is one of the reasons I wrote about it in my book, because I thought, oh, I've got maybe something a little bit different to say about it than what people normally think. One day I thought it was enough. I just thought, enough. As sort of like, same as, say, drinking. I mean, in my 20s I could drink, you know, 1,000 beers and still get up the next day and do stuff. But as you get older, you take longer to recover, you know.
Right.
I can't drink more than a couple of beers, and then it's like, oh, you know, that's enough these days. And it's the same with, you know, drug use. You know, there's always a price to pay. You get high, whatever your drug is, alcohol or other things, and then you get low in, you know, it swings back the other way. So the hangovers get worse, the hangovers get longer, the same as drugs. So you might have, I'll have a day off and I'll, you know, do this. And then you sort of kind of blare for the next couple of days. So it started to sort of creep into my ability to work. So I thought, got to put this away.
So in general, it wasn't something that really dominated your life at, you know, for a long time, and you were able to pull the plug on it before it did, it sounds like.
That's how it felt to me. I mean, there might be other people that have a different view. They might have been probably a bit more worried about my behavior than I was. But I had seen a lot of friends who had been sort of, again, they were occasional users, and then suddenly they got caught, and they were sort of, you know, they had to find drugs every day. So I just hated that idea. Never wanted to be in that position. So,
right. Well, and the new album, you've got a song, "The Body Keeps the Score," which is a great line, and also it's based on what Bessel van der Kolk. He's a Dutch American psychiatrist. It's such an interesting phrase too, just like just sort of the idea that, you know, your body keeps the score. It does remember the things you've done. It's accumulation of whatever your experiences. What was sort of the genesis of like taking that idea and turning that into a song?
Again, well, you know, another sort of long gestation. I listened to the audiobook on a road trip about 5 or 6 years ago. All the way from northern New South Wales to back home to Melbourne. So it's quite a long book. And thought the book was really good. But, you know, the body keeps the score, you know, that I wrote that down straight away as a little note in my notebook.
Right.
It's a great song title. And it was, again, something I sort of played around with from time to time. And, you know, I've got 4 or 5 different melodies of the body keeps the score with sort of just sounds attached. But it just sort of fell into place. I don't know why. I was with my friend Bill Miller. We were playing You know, we get together every now and then and play songs. It's fun, and every now and then we write a song. He wrote, co-wrote 8 hours sleep with me for the last record, Fever, Longing, Steel. And we were just playing around with this little sort of riff on the acoustic guitar and started singing the words, and that sort of so it fell out that way. So again, you know, it's a bit, I had the title for a long time,
Right.
just waiting for that fluke to happen.
Do you look at songwriting as a way to kind of make sense out of, I don't know, what it is to be human and wrestle with whatever we're wrestling with?
In a way, I don't. It's maybe it's not that highfalutin as you suggest, but I definitely have a feeling that because I have, and I have a poor memory, most of life goes past so quickly and so fleetingly. So, you know, and I felt this in my 20s. Like, oh, so much of my life I don't remember. What, you know. I always felt that one reason I like writing was to actually sort of hold on to life in some way, like holding a net out to that the torrent of that life is, and maybe catching some flotsam and jetsam as it goes along. You've got something. So I thought of writing as a kind of way of, it's a different kind of remembering, I guess. It's not like I'm writing autobiography, but it's songs sort of, they sort of mark times of my life, and there's something for me, there's something to show for having lived all this time. Okay, I might not remember much about my life, but I've got these songs. So it's sort of that.
You have like an early song like Dumb Things. You have more recent songs that are also about regrets. I mean, is it helpful to, live a kind of complicated life with lots of ups and downs if you're a songwriter? Because it kind of gives you something to wrestle with, as opposed to if you just sort of coasted like, oh, no, I always made the right decisions. The whole time.
Yeah, I guess I don't think it, I don't know anyone who's sort of who's had a simple life. I think most, even from the outside, you might think, oh, they're normal, they have a simple life. There's not everything's going pretty smoothly. There's always a whole lot of other stuff going on. So I don't subscribe to the theory that you have to have every kind of experience, or you have to go through all this stuff, or you have to go up and down to write songs. I guess, I have, but I don't know whether you need that. And I think most people have that kind of life, no matter.
Right. Well, I think that's why so many people would relate to a song like Dumb Things, because they're like, yeah, I did all the dumb things too. And everyone has their own little subset of what those things are.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, yeah. Life's a struggle and life's fun, so we just sort of try to get the balance right.
You still enjoy playing out?
I love it. I love singing. So I love the feeling after singing, being on stage for 2 hours and singing. And I'm a fair, you know, I'm a push air singer. So if you know what I mean, I'm not, for me to sing for 2 hours is very physical. So I feel physically charged. It's like after exercise. I mean, swimming is something I love to do. So after exercise or swimming, singing, all those things, they make me feel good.
It's
That's
kind of
always
is being on stage like the happy place, as opposed to writing the song or being in the studio to record it.
oh, but yeah, both. I mean, the studio is another happy place in that. Because the way we record is we all set up together as a band, and then we chase the song down. We don't we try to get the song all together, vocals, band, everything, all the parts. Occasionally we'll have a bit of a harmony or maybe another instrument, something. But we get the song, pretty much the whole of the song, playing it together, which often means a lot of takes. Sometimes we're lucky we get things on a first or second take, but often we just you know, we gradually, I got like hunting the song for me. We might do, you know, 20 takes or, you know, 10 or 15 takes one day and say, no, we're not quite there yet, and come back the next day and get it. But so a day in the studio for me is a lot. It's not like I just sort of sing a guide vocal and then we get the song and then, you know, I go and do the vocal later. You know, I'll be singing all day. So, again, you get that's another great feeling of, one, the physical thing of singing. I love the repetition. I love honing in on a song and gradually getting it better, gradually getting the phrasing, the singing better, finding little nuances and so on. And I just love the group mind, the concentration, because, you know, we're trying to get the song in one take. So the concentration every time we go for a take, you know, there's six of us in there, Dan, Ash on guitars, Cameron on keyboards, Bill on bass, and Peter on drums.
Right.
And
these are musicians you've been working with for a long time, so there's like an intuitive connection among all of you.
Yeah. So I love that concentration and that sort of group mind, that you're trying to get to where you're sort of just working as one organism. And that is, you know, that's the greatest human feeling of all, feeling you're part of something that you can't do by yourself. You know, that's why people go to church. That's why people have religion. That's why people join clubs, join choirs, you know, to be part of something that you can't do by yourself. I think that's one of the main things that drive us.
Yeah. And it looks like from your website, you have a lot of tour dates in Australia over the next several months. Is it hard? Is it too impossible to get, you know, the band over to like the US so you could like come play in Chicago and I could see you? Or is that just like, are the economics of that just way too difficult at this point?
Oh, it's possible. The last time we did that was 2017. We took the band over. Then, you know, I've been back with just with Dan, you know, I often tour the States with my nephew Dan as a duo. So, because of economics, you know, COVID sort of just put a dent in everything, slowed everything down in terms of getting back there. No, I'd love to get back there with the band or, you know, or in some iteration, you know, later next year or the year after.
But in the meantime, you're in this part of your career where you have like Russell Crowe and people handing you awards and stuff. So are you enjoying that aspect of it?
Awards are nice, but you know, they're not the main thing. I think for me, the biggest happiness is, you know, having new songs and taking them out and, you know, taking them out and playing them for the first time to people. We've just, you know, just done a tour here and we played Rita Wrote a Letter for the first time. You know, just seeing that song land, you know, to people who hadn't heard it before was a thrill.
Right. It's a great song, but also just the sound of the words Rita Wrote, right there. It's like Rita Wrote a Letter. It just kind of flows right out of your mouth. So aside from the actual content of the song.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there was a movie that came out what, last year, How to Make Gravy?
Yes.
So did you write the song thinking, well, now you got something else to make a movie out of?
No, in fact, you know, we recorded, you know, Rita Wrote a Letter was finished a year and a half ago. And we recorded it in March last year. So it's a year and a half ago. Yeah, so the song was written probably close to, the song was written around Christmas time, 23. And then we recorded it last year. But I knew the movie was coming out. And the movie maker, Meg Washington, is a friend of mine. I said, you know, I knew straight away, this is going to be at odds with the movie because it tells a different story. I said, I've got this song and, you know, I was thinking of putting that Rita Wrote a Letter on the last record. But I thought maybe it's not going to work. I sent the song to Megan and said, what do you think? She said, please don't put it out. Just wait a year. I said, yeah, you're right. Oh, it would have just sort of muddied it, because the movie is sort of a feel-good movie. It's redemption.
Right.
Reader wrote a letter. That sequel could be a sequel to that movie if things went wrong after the end of the movie, but we don't know. But, you know, I didn't want to have this song around at the same time. I wanted to give the movie clear air.
Right.
And Megan was right. I'm glad we did. So we sat on it. So I've been sitting on Rita Road Letter for 2 years thinking, can't wait till this song comes out.
Well, now someone could write a movie sequel to the other movie, which called Rita Wrote a Letter now. So,
well, they could. Yeah.
There you go. And then you could write another song from, well, I guess, you know, I mean, Joe's gone, but, you know, unless
some people have asked me, maybe you can write a prequel to How to Make Ray, because how did Joe end up in prison? So that's been suggested.
See, well, it's always good to have more ideas percolating. Yeah. Thank you so much. I'm really glad that you talked to me, and I really enjoyed this, and I've enjoyed your music for such a long time. And again, when I sort of saw that you had this new album coming, I was like, oh, that would be great. I'd love to talk to him. So thank you.
Thanks, Mark. It's been my pleasure too.
That's it for episode 201 of Carol Pop. Thanks so much to Paul Kelly for sharing insights and stories about his formidable 40-something year career. His new album, 70, is out November 7th on vinyl, CD, and digital on the Cooking Vinyl label. You could order it wherever good music is sold. Learn more about him and his music and books and lyrics at his website, paulkelly.com.au, and dig into his deep catalog while you're at it. If you're in Australia January through March, you can catch Kelly on the Red Hot Summer Tour, because it'll be summer down there, don't you know? Go to his website for details and follow him on Instagram, YouTube, Facebook, and X. Carol Pop is produced by Chris Wake. Thanks to all who support Carol Pop. If you'd like to throw something into the Carol Pop kitty, we'd be much appreciative. I'll give you a shout out on the next episode. You can give $24 or whatever you'd like at carolpop.com. Thanks so much for listening and being here. I'm Mark Caro. Please follow Caro Pop on the so-called socials at Caro Popcast. You can follow me as well at Mark Caro at MarkCaro. Please share this episode, subscribe here and on YouTube, tell your friends, and tune in again next week for another Caro Pop conversation. Thanks.